in a college essay, quote, "Liberty requires vigilance and sacrifice." And he went on to say that the beneficiaries of liberty, that we must keep it safe from attack. And how prescient were those words by Captain Hahn. And I think it just reminds us that it's time for all of us as Americans to honor the sacrifice of Captain Hahn and all the Gold Star families by standing up against hate and bigotry and divisiveness.
Finally, do you find that there is a spike in attacks on Islamic women, on Muslim women in this country this year?
Yes, there has been a disturbing level spike in hate crimes and attacks, Amy, and it seems to unfortunately correlate to the rise in this kind of hateful rhetoric from Mr. Trump and in other presidential candidates. So starting at about end of November, early December of last year, we've been tracking an unprecedented level of hate crimes and attacks against individuals as well as against our houses of worship where men, women, and children frequent. And it's not just our data, but even by the Justice Department's own data has shown a disturbing trend.
We're going to have to leave it there, Farhana Khaira. I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Director of Muslim Advocates, and that does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkner, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen. I am Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
Cabu at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, A Letter from Momo, will play Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. A Letter to Momo has been described as a Japanese anime Alice in Wonderland. As is so often the case in Japanese animation, displacement and emotional upheaval lead to interaction with the supernatural. Again, that's A Letter from Momo, Thursday, August 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Kabu Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Rock the Block Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center in Portland. Activities include crafts, a rock climbing wall, inflatables, a dance party, and resource table from local agencies and businesses. Again, that's the Matt Dishman Community Center Block Party and Appreciation Event, Saturday, August 13th at the Matt Dishman Community Center, 77 Northeast Knott Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
The time is 5:02, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The KBOO Evening News is up next at 5 o'clock, followed by Labor Radio at 6, and Prison Pipeline at 6:30, and Hard Knock Radio at 7, so please stay tuned. The KBOO Evening News produces a one-hour newscast every weeknight. We need writers, editors, reporters, and more to make this grassroots community resource happen. Are you interested? Would you like to try something exciting? Training and writing for radio, interviewing, field recording, and audio editing is all free of charge. But you have to go through the KBOO volunteer orientation first. Email Lisa Loving at newsdirector@kboo.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a report shows Oregon incarcerates African Americans at a rate more than 40% over the national average.
Wildfires are raging through California's Sierra Nevada mountain range, threatening the survival of some of the West Coast's wild forest land.
And we speak with KBOO's own Teresa Mitchell about the protest and other events that took place last week outside the Democratic National Convention in Philadelphia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 1st, 2016. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Rosalind Scott. A new report shows Oregon incarcerates African Americans at a rate more than 40% over the national average, almost double that of Washington State. That's according to the Sentencing Project, a national nonprofit organization that advocates for criminal justice and juvenile justice reform. The report showed that Oregon imprisons 21 out of every 1,000 African Americans, the seventh highest rate in the nation. Although African Americans make up less than 2% of the total population of Oregon, they make up almost 10% of the total prison population. The numbers are even worse in Multnomah County, where African Americans are four times as likely to be imprisoned as whites for the same crimes. In Multnomah County, African Americans make up more than 25% of the total prison population, yet they comprise only 5% of the county's total population. Justice policy analysts say that this report and an earlier report issued in February show African Americans face institutionalized racism when dealing with criminal justice system in the state of Oregon.
The first unmanned speed cameras in Oregon will be installed on Beaverton-Hillsdale Highway this week. Once in place, the cameras could lead to drivers receiving fines of $160 or more for speeding, based on camera evidence alone. In the months to come, cameras will be installed on Marine Drive, Outer Division Street, and on Southeast 122nd Avenue between Foster Road and Powell Boulevard. Each camera system will cost the city over $3,000. The city plans to pay for them with fines gathered from speeding tickets. This is the latest effort by the Bureau of Transportation to cut down on traffic fatalities in Portland. These sorts of cameras have been in use in stoplights, but have only recently been approved for use along the streets of Portland.
Portland Community College has received a grant totaling $1.3 million from the state. The grant helps fund a campaign to encourage college attendance by more students from low-income families. Funding will pass through the PCC's five-year Future Connect scholarship program and will provide an additional 3,000 underprivileged students with services and support. This includes coaching and transfer assistance. Some funds will also go toward the purchase of 47 laptop computers that will be made available to all PCC students for library checkout. Further funding is provided by donors in the cities of Portland, Beaverton, and Hillsboro.
The Regional Arts and Culture Council is making $650,000 in grant funding available for artistic projects and events to take place next year. Anyone with a project in mind will have to act fast because the deadline to file an intent to apply is this Wednesday at 5 p.m. Awards range from $1,000 to $7,000 each. Individual artists and nonprofit organizations in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties are encouraged to apply. Successful proposals will involve the creation or presentation of a performance, exhibit, or other work of art that's available to the general public sometime in 2017. Last year, RAC funded 131 projects. More information and application packets are available from the RAC website at racc.org.
Oregon ranks 50th in total corporate tax burden, and many out-of-state companies generate huge revenues in Oregon while paying very little in taxes. Comcast, in particular, is frequently singled out as a company that does not pay its fair share. KBOO reporter Jamani Ward-Lewis had a chance to speak to Diana Pei-Wu of Portland Jobs with Justice about the Comcast tax issue.
Can you, like, sketch out what the issue is all about with Comcast?
Yeah, absolutely. So as many people know, Oregon has the lowest corporate taxes of any state in the United States. And Comcast is one of those many, many corporations who makes over $25 million in profits in our state and doesn't give back to, you know, the roads, the schools, all of the services that make their business possible and that make their profits possible in this state. On top of not paying corporate taxes that nobody pays, you know, Comcast also applied for a tax break that would give them like tens of millions of dollars in tax breaks that they wouldn't pay for a low-cost service for low-income people that they don't provide. Yesterday, we were out in front of the Comcast on 70th and Sandy, and we talked to easily a half dozen or dozen people in an hour who were coming out of that building, and they were frustrated with Comcast service. They were frustrated with the service that they did get, and all of them, every single person, felt that they were paying more than they could afford for internet service, and not one of them identified that they could find a low-cost service for low-income people. The seniors are like, there's no senior discount, which is sort of normal in the industry. And so it's a real hardship for people to just have basic internet or phone service at their houses. So we at Portland Jobs with Justice are working with the Oregon Consumer League to raise the spotlight about Comcast's tax dodging. So, you know, the taxes that corporations pay in the state go to providing things like early childhood education services, health care and home care for seniors so they can age in place, right, and age with their families where it's possible, and also to health care.
What obstacles do you guys face?
We know that just a few weeks ago, several corporations, including like Wells Fargo and other large banks, and other corporations dumped a bunch of money, several million dollars, into running ad campaigns against this initiative and against Measure 97.
How do, like, average consumers participate with you?
Folks out there who are interested in knowing more about the campaign can do two things. The first one is go to the Oregon Consumer League webpage, Oregon Consumer League, and sign the petition. That will put them on the mailing list for this issue. The second thing or third thing that they can do is join Jobs with Justice's page. And so you can sign up for our email list on our webpage, jwjpdx.org, and you can like our Facebook page to stay in touch about these kinds of actions. And that's just Portland Jobs with Justice on Facebook.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
If you turned on the news last week, you're sure to see images from inside the Democratic National Convention. What you most likely didn't see was the action happening outside of the convention hall. To talk to us about the happenings outside the DNC, we're joined by KBOO's own Teresa Mitchell.
Good afternoon.
Teresa, thanks very much for coming in.
My pleasure.
You were in Philadelphia this last week, but not inside the convention hall, as most of the news outlets were. They seemed to restrict their coverage to inside. What were you there to cover?
I was there to cover what was happening in the streets and raised money to that effect. And the people of Portland sent me to Philadelphia, basically, to do that. So I was able to check it out from outside. Basically, I was outside City Hall in downtown Philadelphia, where the subway entrance was, or a subway entrance that a lot of people took from their hotels. And I also went to the Wells Fargo Center and the adjoining FDR Park, where there was a great deal of protest.
So how close did you get to the convention center itself?
I got as close as the 15 to 20 foot fences would allow. I've never seen such fences. They were truly titanic, and they were everywhere. There was not one inch was allowed open, and they arranged them around the subway entrance, and they set it so that protesters were separated from delegates by their credentials, or everyone was separated from delegates, actually. And anyone who didn't have credentials was run off into an area which had joined into FDR Park, which formed a very nice cul-de-sac for bottling everyone up. And the only way to get back was, if you were not a delegate, again, was to walk back, because they would not allow you back on the subway without credentials.
Oh, without delegate credentials?
Yes.
There was a lot of people walking back then.
There were some people walking back, and I think the whole idea was to make it difficult and in the summer heat rather, you know, painful to go out and protest, and you would see just how much time and effort it would take you. Having said that, I was surprised to find that the police presence was not, by and large, particularly threatening, especially not compared to other protests I've been to.
So it was mostly the walls that they set up and these restrictions in terms of credentials.
I would say that. And when it came to the tenor of the protests, they were rather, they were restrained, I would say. There was a lot of shouting, but it was not... I've compared it to the battle in Seattle, but not in terms of violent energy, in terms of activist energy. It was like that. I haven't seen that much activist energy since then. And that was, I'm referring to the anti-WTO protests in Seattle 1999.
And there was violence there, right?
There was violence there. And there wasn't violence here, but that's because the people who were out demonstrating just were not inclined to be that way. And plus, the cops had undertaken to show up without their their armor, which must have been a relief to them in the 93-degree heat and humidity.
It seemed less confrontational.
But it had a very interesting quality to it.
I guess my biggest question, and this is related to exactly what we're talking about, and we talked about this a little earlier when you got in, was before the convention itself, we heard how there might be like Chicago 1968 all over again happening there in Philadelphia.
And I thought so too. I went there because there were so many people coming, and some people were saying very militant things. But there was one group of people who tried to climb the fence and promptly got arrested. I don't think they tried to make a secret of the fact that they intended to climb the fence, but that fence was really quite something. I would say the fence had a lot to do with things not being more militant than they were. It was just hard to get past it.
And then the police presence, there were a lot of police, but they weren't in military gear. And
They weren't in the Darth Vader outfits that were in downtown Portland. But they were everywhere. They were rather helpful. I would say something else has begun in Philadelphia, though. I interviewed a couple of the protesters out at the protest outside the Wells Fargo Center, and you might want to run that tape.
Oh, we have some audio then that Teresa brought back. Let's listen to that now.
Hi, can I ask you what brings you to the DNC today?
Fine for Bernie. Wouldn't mind seeing him elected.
Yeah? Yeah. Did you travel far to get here?
Yeah, from Atlanta.
Atlanta, that's quite a ways. Did you arrive just today?
Yesterday, last night actually, yeah.
Are you going to be here for the whole convention?
Yep, be here for, the week. Yeah, so looking forward to it, it's gonna be fun.
So you'd like to see the convention just go for Bernie, and how would that happen? I mean, what would be the mechanism?
To get Bernie elected.
To get Bernie elected, I mean, there's been some talk that Hillary should be disqualified for throwing the primaries.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good thing, yeah. I mean, look, they've been saying for a while that, she's the presumptive nominee because she got she won more pledged delegates, but that's all she is, the presumptive nominee. Like, there's still a good chance that if the delegates, if they deliberate on these issues and of whether or not she can actually be elected president, beat Trump, then maybe they'll see that we've got a better choice.
I've heard there's a poll out saying that Bernie still beats Trump by 10%.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, at least double digits. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, to me, it's a sure thing. I think it'll be a landslide if we get him. But.
And you have an interesting shirt. You have Bernie, but he has glasses on. It says Heisenberg. Oh, I get it. Reference to
Breaking Bad.
Breaking Bad.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, Heisenberg. That's a different one. Thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome.
Hi, can I ask you what issues brought you out today?
Just to support Bernie and show a united front against the establishment and that Hillary and Trump are not our only options, and we would like to see some change.
After the convention, supposing that they don't, in fact, scotch Hillary because she threw the primaries, who do you think that you'll be voting for?
I will not be voting for either Trump or Hillary. I will vote for whoever else is on the ballot.
Jill Stein, perhaps?
Perhaps. That is my first choice, but there are other options if she's not on the ballot.
Thank you. And did you travel far to get here today?
I'm from Austin, Texas.
Austin, Texas. Yes. Wow. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Oh, Teresa, I had a question based on that audio. Did the interviews when Bernie was still... not totally out of the
that was Tuesday, yeah.
Yeah, Hillary was, as you mentioned, the presumptive nominee. Was there much of a reaction after Hillary was officially nominated?
There really was. It's an interesting thing because it kind of set these people up emotionally. The two that I picked out there were fairly typical. They went from across the country. Some of them came from Los Angeles. Some of them caravaned. They camped in parks. And they had this idea that they, by the strength of their passion and their numbers, they were somehow going to alter the DNC now.
Very optimistic.
It makes you know, if you've been following politics, it kind of makes you smile. Of course, you know, DNC is not going to do any such thing. But they didn't know this necessarily. Many of them were very young. I noticed there was a difference in age and class between Hillary supporters and Bernie supporters. And so they hoped for, at least for some great compromise, they hoped that Elizabeth Warren would be on the ticket, perhaps something like that, some, you know, absolute commitment to go by the their victories on the platform. And of course, they received no such thing. And when it came out, I actually saw them crying. People were holding each other in groups, tears on their faces, crying because they were so disappointed. But by that time, the very next day, I saw a very different energy because all of them had gone through all of that together. They had come together. They were making social Facebook and Twitter connections, meeting and greeting each other and going through all of this together, and also going through that emotional letdown together. And coming out of it, I saw, there was just this energy. There was energy on the streets of people coming together. And as soon as someone would raise their voice at a cafe or on the sidewalk, even about politics, two or three people would gather together and this good-natured debate about politics would start. And it just seems, you know, kind of fairy tale for someone like me. You know, I always wished I could see something like that. And of course, it was very temporary.
Emphasis on the good-natured.
Yeah, it was. It was.
That is unusual these days.
Yeah, these people are not like 68 Chicago. It's Pegasus, man. We're voting for Pegasus and the hell with the rest. You know, it wasn't like that.
And the last person you interviewed mentioned that she's not voting for Bernie, not voting for Hillary or Trump, and possibly Jill Stein. Did you find that was the majority opinion, or will people kind of bite the bullet and vote for Hillary in the election?
Some will bite the bullet because they are afraid of Trump. It's also familiar to people our age, isn't it? Because we heard the same thing in 72 about Nixon. We can't let Nixon be the president. She wanted Stein. I would say Stein was the winner of the whole thing. Stein was just bursting with energy and poise and presence. And I taped her at a public meeting, of which she had several, and at a news conference, and also at the Socialist Convergence.
Oh, and so Jill Stein was there.
Yeah.
But she wasn't allowed in the convention hall? Or what? Of course, you were outside, so...
I don't know what her status was in that regard. I had the idea that she was allowed in at some point. Although, of course, other people were notoriously kicked out, and that was not in the press. I was so proud to be an Oregonian with the delegation acting the way they did.
And that was an excellent report. Again, it's something that I personally did not hear much of what was happening outside, Teresa. So thanks very much for coming in today. And
it's my pleasure.
And also thanks for going to Philadelphia for KBOO.
Thank you so much.
That was KBOO's own Teresa Mitchell joining us live here in Studio 2 after her week covering everything not happening inside of the DNC.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth feature on the Portland Mercado and its latest venture, El Mercadito. At 6, it's Labor Radio. Tonight's show follows up on a panel discussion regarding racial, economic justice, and the fight for equality in labor. That's followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30, which tonight features a discussion with artist and justice reform activist Tony Papa about his new book, This Side of Freedom, Life After Clemency. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, increasing clouds with a low around 58. Tomorrow, a 20% chance of showers before 11 a.m. Cloudy through mid-morning, then gradual clearing with a high near 74. Today in history, in 1943, 2 days of rioting in Harlem, New York, were touched off by a report of a New York police officer shooting an African-American veteran. According to an NYPD report, 5 African-Americans were killed by police, close to 400 people were injured, and police arrested approximately 500 African-American men and women. The quote of the day is by James Baldwin, who said, "Children have never been very good at listening to their elders, but they have never failed to imitate them."
Portland favorite Nikki Brown has been pleasantly surprised with a mural in her honor in the Alberta neighborhood. Nikki has recently moved out of Portland, but was involved with the project that many feel just scratches the surface of the greatness that is Nikki Brown Clown.
What's in the mural?
The mural is actually, it's myself, Nikki Brown Clown, and then I have had a chance to either handpick children who have made an impact on me or been involved, children from the neighborhood, so it's all children. And it's a children's parade because I'm known for being in parades, and it's the Nikki Brown Clown Super Reading Parade. So it's a parade of children. There's children doing somersaults. They're playing instruments. There's cute animals. I believe the animal that's jumping through a hula hoop in front of me on the mural is the homeowner's, Diane Freeney, the dog, Daphne. And my granddaughter is on the mural. She won't be part of the parade, but there's a small patch for my family. So they'll be my granddaughter and my second cousin will be forever embedded in there. And so my granddaughter Melody will be over there picking. She won't be standing up. She'll be kneeling down picking flowers because, after all, she's not a Nikki Brown Clown fan. I'm grandma.
Did some of the children get involved with the painting of it?
Absolutely. So we have Robin, who's a muralist, and she's done some really cool work that you've probably already seen. She did the mural, the African-American Women of Portland mural down off the interstate, and she's also did the one on bicycling, Bike Center on Alberta, I think.
Oh, okay.
That one. Yeah, she did that one on the side of the bike building, and beautiful. So what she did is she's, and maybe a couple, two other artists worked with it, but she invited anybody who could hold a paintbrush. I've even did a little bit. So everyone was involved, you know, people from the neighborhood, people from Nikki Brown Clown fans from all over. Sometimes people would just be walking by and say, what's going on? We would tell them and they would stop what they were doing and, you know, pick up a paintbrush and start painting. So it's still in progress. So you guys are more than welcome to stop over at 1006 Northeast Emerson Street.
Okay. So what is your hope for Northeast Portland families?
And my hope for Northeast Portland families is to be able to use literacy as a way to bridge the gap between multi-generational, ethnic group, and all, just bridge the line and to come together and create a space where everyone can come together to not only work, play, and worship together, but just also just be able to just get along. And I think that the most empowering thing is being able to read, because that's just a fundamental.
That is very true. Is there anything else about your work or Northeast Portland families that I haven't asked yet?
I just wanted to just to give a shout-out to Diane Freeney because I wanted to tell a little bit more, just a quick, where the mural is. I look forward to, it's not only her personal house, but she also has in the front, it's actually a duplex. She lives in the back, but the front part is also an open art gallery. And so I'm hoping that, Diane, I was really impressed the fact that when she moved into Northeast Portland, that she opened up her home literally and physically. And so I hope that people continue to look up the Emerson House Art Gallery and use that as a community space to come together regardless of their age and race and background and whatever. So to me, that's the Nikki Brown Clown way, and that's what I kind of wanted to have. And so through books and arts, and so if they were looking a place to continue to look for the Emerson House to offer. So on the outside doors of the Nikki Brown Clown Library, there will be posted events that will be open to the community, and hopefully they'll be free.
All right. Well, thank you for talking.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you guys checking in with me. And super excited that we're going to have radio personality Reggae Bob come out on Saturday for the Nikki Brown Clown Block Party from 11 to 2.
Well, I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. Have a great one. Thanks for calling.
For KBOO News, I'm Jamani Ward-Lewis.
The ferocity of recent wildfires in California's Sierra Nevada mountain range has been alarming as drought, insect infestation, and the effects of climate change conspire to threaten the survival of some of the West Coast's most wild forest lands. 66 million trees are already dead, and that could increase to 100 million by the end of this year. And it's not just the trees that will suffer. Vic Bedouin with Free Speech Radio News takes a closer look at why.
Riding in his pickup truck near Shaver Lake, Jim Bluestein reflects how this mountainous landscape is changing. Bluestein manages a 134-acre tract owned by the Sierra Music and Arts Institute. He says it was once some of the healthiest ponderosa and sugar pine forest around. But now...
we are experiencing cataclysmic changes, and they are accelerating because there's so many effects and causes that we aren't even clued into, which are already in effect.
Bluestein and his crews have been working for years to remove the hazardous buildup of dead wood and undergrowth that could fuel the next wildfire. Commercial timber interests say one solution is more widespread logging. Bluestein disagrees.
Number one, we should not, in fact, be cutting any healthy, maturing timber. Number two, we should, in most of these out-of-control, overgrown forests, we should be cutting most of what is 10 inches in diameter and smaller. Most of the brush, most of the thicket.
By this method, Bluestein argues, we're left with sparser forest. That, in turn, allows more water for trees that are left to grow healthier, and also more water soaks into the ground, feeding the state's rivers, streams, and aquifers. So just how much of this dead wood is out there? Carolyn Ballard, the U.S. Forest Service's fire management officer for the High Sierras, has the figures.
400,000 acres, you know, of dead trees on the Sierra National Forest alone. There's a lot of ground. It's about a third of the forest. It's about half of our conifer base.
Ballard attributes much of this dry, combustible dead wood to the work of pine bark beetles. Drought conditions have weakened conifers, making them prime habitat for tiny pests to lay waste to the Sierra's ponderosa and sugar pine. It gets worse. Ballard says these pine bark beetles now have company.
It's primarily between 6,000 and 5,500 feet in elevation, but we're seeing more mortality from a fir engraver beetle moving up to about 7,000 feet in elevation, where we're losing 40 to 50% of our white fir trees.
It's not just about the trees. This mountain range is one of the primary sources of water and hydropower for California's population and farmland. And the vegetation and the soil itself capture carbon in the atmosphere to mitigate against climate change. Roger Bales is director of the Sierra Nevada Research Institute based at the University of California, Merced. He says the good news is that California's water users are beginning to recognize how vital these forests are for the state's health.
The Association of California Water Agencies over 2 years ago passed a board resolution pointing out the need for watershed restoration and maintaining our headwaters as part of the water infrastructure.
Water users are at last recognizing the cyclical nature of drought. Less water, weaker trees, more insects, more dying trees, leading to less water. This summer, California Assemblyman Jim Patterson toured the Shaver Lake area to view the devastation. He promised to use the emergency situation to focus government action more quickly.
The upside of emergency is you learn what you can do when your focus is on the emergency and on fundamental priorities, yeah. And you see that it happens. Yeah. And, you know, we learned a lot, I think, over the last 40, 50 years.
Then there's climate change. Average temperatures in the High Sierras have risen by 5 degrees over the past 20 years. California Governor Jerry Brown has already allocated $30 million this year to remove dead trees threatening official infrastructure like roads, power lines, homes, and public spaces. But forestry manager Carolyn Ballard says that does nothing toward addressing the underlying problems or restoring the health of forests.
We need to move forward into looking at reforestation, and we need to look at resiliency treatments and things that we can do. In terms of what kind of forest or what kind of landscape do we want to have in, say, 5 years, 10 years, and 20 years.
From behind the wheel of his Toyota pickup, Bluestein says small crews could be deployed to get work to suppress fire hazards without doing more damage to the ecosystem.
Thousands of small crews would be moved into the forest, like, right away. And they would have chainsaws, they would have chippers. That way, the material that we cut and thin, we can clean it up as we go, get that carbon low, where it can help to keep moisture and nutrients and microbial action on the forest.
But with state funds for forest conservation scarce, it would likely be up to the federal government to step in. Scientists, forestry managers, and others know that these woods are trying to convince decision makers from state capitals to Capitol Hill that the need for action is now, before it's too late. Vic Bedoyan, FSRN, Shaver Lake, California.
A large wildfire, estimated to have burned more than 70,000 acres, is heading toward the Hanford Nuclear Reservation in south-central Washington. The fire started Saturday in Yakima County and, pushed by strong winds, quickly jumped Highway 24. More than 100 firefighters worked through the night in an attempt to build containment lines around the fire. News of the wildfire burning toward Hanford is just one of several recent stories related to the aging and leaking former nuclear weapons production facility, which houses almost 70% of America's high-level radioactive nuclear waste. In July, the Attorney General of Washington State filed an emergency legal motion against Hanford to force the facility to improve worker safety. The lawsuit was filed after more than 60 employees at Hanford were sickened by exposure to radioactive vapors over a three-month period earlier this year. The Washington suit joins a 2015 lawsuit claiming Hanford violated state and federal regulations by knowingly exposing employees to toxic chemical vapors. Both of the lawsuits named Hanford, the Federal Department of Energy, and the Washington River Protection Solutions Company, which is a private corporation hired to manage the radioactive storage tanks at Hanford. In addition to the safety violation lawsuits, more than 500 current and former employees of Hanford have announced plans to file a class action lawsuit against Hanford and Lockheed Martin over what the employees claim are 20 years of illegal pension and benefit cuts.
On Friday, a federal appeals court struck down a restrictive North Carolina voting law stating that various provisions of the law targeted African Americans with almost surgical precision. The 2013 North Carolina voter ID law required photo ID to vote, reduced early voting, eliminated same-day registration, and ended Sunday voting. The ruling by the 4th District Court of Appeals declared that the North Carolina law violated both the U.S. Constitution and the Federal Voting Rights Act. The court also found that the law was intended to disenfranchise largely minority, Democratic Party voters and in order to keep Republican Party in power. Republican Governor Pat McCrory has vowed to immediately appeal the ruling.
The legislature of Morocco passed a law last Tuesday aimed at improving the lot of the country's domestic workers. The U.S.-based group Human Rights Watch praised the law after reporting on the grim state of domestic workers in Morocco in 2005-2012. The group found that such workers, many of them underage girls known as little maids, experienced physical abuse, overwhelming workloads, and a quarter of the earnings of other workers in Morocco. Part of the reason is that Morocco's 60 to 90,000 domestic workers are not protected under the country's labor laws. The new law sets the minimum age for this sort of work at 16 and sets wage and hour limits as well. All of the new limits are still short of the standards set by Morocco's general labor law, especially when it comes to the age limit. Many people fighting for the bill, including the Casablanca-based advocacy group INSAF, wanted the minimum age set at 18, Morocco's legal age of adulthood. However, the ruling party lowered the limit to 16 years with a promise to raise it to 18 in 5 years. INSAF called this, quote, a five-year period in which the exploitation of minors will be permitted. Both watchdog groups also expressed reservations about the willingness and ability of Morocco's government to properly enforce the law, but claim it's a step in the right direction. And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Monday, August 1st, 2016. Three Palestinians injured, at least two dozen others kidnapped as Israeli troops invade West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Undercover Israeli soldiers infiltrated early on Monday morning into the Dehesh refugee camp south of the West Bank city of Bethlehem, shot and injured three Palestinians and kidnapped two others. Local sources said that undercover soldiers infiltrated into the refugee camp using a civilian car with Palestinian license plates, but were soon discovered by many youngsters who hurled stones on them. The soldiers fired many live rounds, wounding three Palestinians. In addition, the soldiers invaded Taqwa town east of Bethlehem, searched homes and kidnapped two Palestinians. Moreover, dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Monday at dawn the town of Dura and Surif, south of the southern West Bank district of Hebron, stormed and violently searched dozens of homes before kidnapping 16 Palestinians in Dura, three in Sa'ir and one in Surif. Also on Monday, Israeli soldiers kidnapped five Palestinians in the West Bank districts of Nablus, Jenin, and Jerusalem and claimed to locate gas bombs, homemade guns, magazines, and workshop for manufacturing weapons. Furthermore, the soldiers invaded Qalqilya city in the northern part of the West Bank, invaded three workshops, and confiscated lathe machines reportedly used for manufacturing homemade weapons. In Gaza, Israeli Navy ships attacked Palestinian fishing boats near the Gaza City shoreline on Monday. Local sources said that the fishermen had to sail back to shore fearing from a Navy gunfire. Damage to the boats were reported. Also in Gaza, Israeli troops stationed at the southern borders of the coastal enclave opened fire at Palestinian farmers working on their lands. The farmers were forced to leave the area in fear of being injured. Palestinian human rights groups say that since the beginning of this year, seven Palestinians were killed, including two children, in addition to 155 injured, among them 26 children, by army gunfire at border areas of the Gaza Strip while working on their lands. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, August 1st, 2016 News Roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Jorish Maui and me, Ghassan Bandura.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Morgan Lloyd, Jamani Ward-Lewis, Ray Bodewell, and Al Khan. The producer is Doug McVeigh. Special thanks to Jenna Yokoyama, and our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Rosalind Scott.
And I'm Ken Jones. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, the topic is the aftermath of the national conventions and the words and actions of candidate Trump. At 9, on Alternative Radio, writer Thomas Frank talks about what's wrong with the Democratic Party. At 10, Air Cascadia has taken the day off. We'll hear Flashpoints, investigative talk radio. At 11, on Stage and Studio, we hear Scene on Radio, a documentary about radio storytellers. And at 11:30, on Art Focus, host Joseph Gallivan speaks with Sarah Kudrowski, curator of modern and contemporary art at the Portland Art Museum. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on donate. Good night, Rosalind.
Good night, Ken. Good night, Danielle.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Hacienda Community Development Corporation has been around since 1992, helping with developing affordable housing, home ownership, and educational income building opportunities. KABU's Jumani Ward Lewis spoke with Jamie Melton about the Mercado and its place in the Latino community.
So yeah, what is the Portland Mercado?
The Portland Mercado is a project that was developed by a local Portland nonprofit, Hacienda CDC. Hacienda CDC has been around since 1992, and we're mostly known for developing affordable housing, doing home ownership, and then some educational and income building opportunities and services for residents living in our housing and others around Portland. About 80% of the community we serve is Latino, and so about 9 years ago, folks that were living in our affordable housing complexes were looking for places to start businesses or find work to support their families, and so we started working with a group of tamayeras, or women making tamales, so they could sell in the farmer's market, and it was a really big success, but that one day a week working in the farmer's market wasn't quite enough to support their families, and so we started looking at options to create what we call the Mercado, Portland Mercado, to have a stable location for businesses to launch and grow that was open, more than just one day a week.